This program is for entertainment and educational purposes and without warranty as to completeness and accuracy of the commentary or opinions. The opinions expressed are solely those of the host and not those of the sponsors or affiliate attorneys or this radio station. No attorney-client relationship is established by any response or commentary on a legal subject. Alabama law requires the following disclaimer. No representation is made that the quality of legal services to be performed is greater than the legal service of other lawyers. Welcome to Law Chat 24/7, a weekly show that reviews and discusses legal issues that impact you and our community. Sponsored by Boatler Richardson Wolf Injury Lawyers, proudly serving the citizens of the Alabama, Mississippi, Florida Gulf Coast since 1987. Now, your hosts of Law Chat 24/7, attorney Mark Wolf and his co-host Marion Boatler.
Good evening, this is attorney Mark Wolf of Boatler Richardson Wolf. Welcome to Law Chat 24/7, our radio show that is affiliated with our LawChat247.com website and our LawChat247 Facebook page, where you can send in a question or an inquiry about a legal matter at either the Facebook page or the website, and you will get a response from an attorney within 24 hours. I'm happy to welcome back my co-host, Marion Boatler. Hey, Marion, how are you doing?
Hey, Mark, I'm doing great. I ended the school year and had to get children all organized, so I'm glad to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back, and you've had some exciting news in your household last Friday when your husband got nominated for a judgeship.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're very proud of him and think he would be a wonderful judge, and just thank God for, and you know, for everything that has been given to us. So very proud of him.
Yes, and for those that may not know, Knox Boatler, my law partner, Marion's husband, was nominated Friday by the Judicial Nominating Committee here in Mobile County to fill one of the circuit court judgeship spots. He was nominated along with two other attorneys, and now those three names have gone to the governor, Kay Ivey, for her to make a decision on who is going to be our next circuit judge in Mobile County. So we're hoping and praying that everything works in the way Knox would like it to and Marion would like it to. So we hope things continue to go well for y'all. So that's exciting news.
It is. And actually, I think, Mark, y'all have exciting news as a law firm as well, being nominated as for the NAPI Awards for the Lanyap magazine. So I think we all need to get out and vote for the law firm. That's exciting too, Mark.
Yeah, that's very exciting. We're very happy to see that. Boatler Richardson Wolf Injury Lawyers were nominated as the best personal injury law firm in Mobile. And us, and I think it's four or five other law firms, all very, very good law firms, very, very good lawyers. So we're very excited and thankful for our friends that have helped nominate us. And we feel like we're in very, very good company, win or lose.
Exactly.
So we appreciate that.
Right.
So.
And I think we can vote every day.
I think that's the way it works. I think that's the way it works. So I think, and I did post something on our Facebook page. I think voting starts tomorrow at noon or something. So if you're so inclined, please go vote for us. We'd certainly appreciate that. We're going to move into some questions. But before we get to our first questions, the first two questions we have tonight, both deal with back child support. So in advance of the show, I did a little research, internet research, for what that is worth, and we have a very, very large amount of money that is calculated to be in arrearage for child support in the United States. And Mary, do you want to take any kind of a guess on what that number might be?
Oh, goodness. I don't even know. I can't even guess.
It is approximately $154 billion.
What?
That is
wow.
Owed in back child support or late child support payments. That's an awfully, awfully big number. It apparently grows by about $13.5 billion a year that gets added to that number. So
wow.
It's and as we all know, if parents aren't supporting the child, then taxpayers end up supporting the child. So,
exactly.
But
wow,
with that,
I would not have expected it to be that large.
Yeah, it's apparently the U.S. Census report from 2018 said that apparently 60% of child support is received timely, but 40% each year is either late or not paid. So that's And so with those numbers, let's jump into these first two questions. Maybe we might have a bad attitude on these, but we'll see what we can do. We'll see what we can do.
But here is our first question for today. It's from the LawChat247.com website. John asks, I want to name my son as beneficiary for a life insurance policy. I do not want the funds seized. Can life insurance left to my son as beneficiary be seized for errors in child support?
And again, asking about arrears of child support, and the answer to that is basically yes. The child support lien, if it has been recognized, and DHR, Department of Human Resources, in our state is charged with trying to collect back child support and arrearages. If that lien is public record and the insurance company is aware of it, they will pay those benefits to the back child support. Now, the interesting thing is that if a person dies owing child support and they have life insurance that pays out to beneficiaries, the child support, they cannot attach those life insurance proceeds that are being paid out to beneficiaries. But if a beneficiary is receiving an insurance benefit, and we actually run into this a number of times on personal injury cases that we handle, where someone's been injured or hurt and the insurance company doesn't want to pay out because they're on notice of a child support lien, so we have to work through the child support lien issues. So the answer to the question is yes. Those insurance benefits can be attached if he is named as a beneficiary. There are ways to get around that, so to speak, but those are becoming very complex and would require basically trust and all that. So, but anyway, so that's an interesting question, and we're ready for number two.
Right. Well, the next question is from Chris, and he asks, my wife and I recently had a baby. I owe back child support to my ex-wife for my 7-year-old son. I have also gone back to school, so I am not working full-time anymore. Based on these facts, can I get the court to reduce my monthly child support owed to my ex-wife?
And this is basically talking about a modification of a child support order, which you can do. You can go back in and have child support guidelines re-examined and ask the court to modify child support. The answer to Chris's question is maybe. It depends upon, a lot will depend upon the judge and the judge's view of the arrearage and whether or not the judge will take that into consideration when determining whether or not to give him a reduction based upon the fact that he now has another child to support and is not working full time. I would counsel Chris to consult with an attorney in that area. And these type of things do differ from state to state, but I would counsel him to talk with an attorney to get a better feel for how the judge in his case, that's handling his case or over his case, feels and views the arrearage issue when someone's requesting a modification. I understand that some judges basically won't undertake any type of modification if there's an arrearage, and that's kind of their discretion. But the other thing that Chris has to recognize is when seeking a modification, even though he's no longer fully employed, and going back to school is a great thing, but just because he's no longer full-time employed, the judge can, in his or her discretion, basically say, well, that was a decision you made, and I feel like you're underemployed, and I'm going to set your child support rates and for the guidelines at a rate that I think is comparable to what you could be making or should be making. So the judge can actually impute a wage level in that situation, and then factor that into the modifications. And again, this is where a local attorney can help give you guidance on how the judge will look at or view those issues. So All right. Mm-hmm. Quick first segment. We'll be back in just about 30 seconds. You going to tell them how they can get a question answered, Marion?
Absolutely. Just go to the LawChat247.com or website or the Facebook page, LawChat247.com, and type it in your message.
Thank you. We'll be back shortly.
Welcome back to Law Chat 24/7. To be a part of the show and to have your legal questions answered, email Mark Wolf. Details online at lawchat247.com. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Wolf and Marion Boatler.
Well, welcome back to Law Chat 24/7. Before we move into our next set of questions, I did just want to share some information with our listeners. If you're listening to our show on the radio in your car and you get home, you can listen to our show live from the FMTalk1065.com website. So if you want to continue listening to the show when you get home and we're still on the air, just go in and hook up your device and log into FMTalk1065.com, and you'll see the live listen button, and you can listen to our show then. And the other thing, too, is we try every week before the show, Monday or Tuesday, after we've gone through the week's questions and decided which questions we're going to be using, we try to make a post on our Facebook page to give you an idea of what questions we're going to be handling and in what segment. So if you want to tune in and listen to a specific area, like last week we did a segment on car crashes. Week before that we did a segment on workers' comp. We've got a segment coming up on class actions and mass torts. So we'll try to put that information out there for you so you can kind of keep up, because, you know, you may not want to listen to the whole show, but there may be something of interest for you. So just a reminder, and again, you can go to our website, lawchat247.com, or our Facebook page and submit questions. So, all right. Well, Marion, let's jump into our next question. What's up next?
Yes. Great, Mark. This is from our Law Chat 24/7 Facebook page. Jean wants to know, are Zillow estimates the way home values are determined in bankruptcy? The Zillow estimate is much higher than tax assessed amount.
All right. We have addressed the bankruptcy questions about the different types of bankruptcies for individuals in prior shows. We have a Chapter 7, which is total liquidation, and a Chapter 13, which is basically debt restructure and repayment, either in full or in part. The Chapter 7 is usually pretty quick, 4 to 6 months. The Chapter 13 can go anywhere from 3 to 5 years. And the determining factor, there's guidelines that the court looks to determine if you qualify for a Chapter 7 total liquidation or if you have to go with a Chapter 13 restructure. One of the biggest items that are assets that people have when they're going into a bankruptcy is their home. And what the court looks at is the amount of equity that you might have in that home, along with other assets, to decide if you should go Chapter 7 or Chapter 13. If you have too much equity above their benchmark, along with other assets, then you may have to go to Chapter 13. And I suspect that's why Gene wanted to know this answer. Mm-hmm. And the answer is that basically the court looks to the fair market value of your home in determining that asset level. And so in her situation, she's like, well, the Zillow estimate is higher than my tax assessment amount. And that's going to be generally true, because the assessed amount for taxes is generally lower and not reflective of the fair market value. And the Zillow estimate, it could be just one of many different estimates that the court looks at to try to determine what the fair market value is. The court can even, if there's an issue and it's a close call, the court can actually request and get an appraisal, a full-blown appraisal of the property for making this determination to determine how much equity may be in the home. So that's why I think she was asking that question, and we'd already given her that information and also gave her the name of a bankruptcy attorney that she could consult with further. So that was a good question, and again, helps us talk a little bit about the difference between Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 bankruptcy. So, All right, how about next? What's up next?
Okay, our next question is from Belinda. She posted the following inquiry to the LawChat247.com website page. He said, last Saturday while driving through Mobile, I got premium gas for my vehicle, and 30 minutes later, the car started to cut off and hesitate when accelerating. I've always used premium gas and have never had a problem. I talked to a mechanic, and he said I probably got some bad gas. He recommended a gas treatment product. If this does not work, he said the repairs are very expensive. How do I go about making the gas station pay for the repairs if they are needed?
All right. This question falls back into a common theme we have in a lot of our responses, and we have to look to the burden of proof. When you're making a claim or asserting a claim against anybody or an insurance company or any type of matter in court or a legal claim, you carry the burden of proof, meaning you have to prove the legitimacy of your claim by the evidence that, you have. In this situation, the difficulty is going to be if she has to go back to the gas station and try to get them to cover the repairs, actually proving that the gas they had there was bad. In this situation, I mean, she could have, if she topped up on a half tank, then and only went 30 miles before she started having problems, or 30 minutes before having problems, they would probably say, well, it might have been the prior gas that you had in there, or it may have been something else that we didn't cause. Our gas wasn't bad. So it could be very, very difficult to prove the gas was bad. What I would recommend, and what I think I always told Belinda to do, would be, let's first off hope that she doesn't have the repairs, that the additive works. That's number one. But two, in just in case it may not, to go ahead and send something to the gas station, either by fax or by email or regular mail, but make sure she keeps a copy, just saying, letting them know in writing, hey, I think I got some bad gas. I was at your gas station on this date at this time, and hopefully she still has her receipt, or she'll have maybe a credit card that she can document the time she was there. I purchased this much gas. I'm having these problems. And just to let them know that this may be a claim and may have to be dealt with in the future. But legally, she might have a very difficult time if the gas station declines and says, well, we don't think our gas was bad. She might have a very difficult time legally proving the gas was bad. And it may be one of those situations where the expense of trying to prove the claim outweighs the economic benefit of the claim. So, again, a difficult situation. Hopefully, the additive will work. So, how about next question?
The next question is, it says, I was attacked at a grocery store in 2018. An employee accused me of stealing, which I did not do. She tried to take the item back from me, and we got into a tussle. Another employee came up and body slammed me on the floor. I went to the ER, and they stated that my brain was bruised from the slam. My right hand was also sprained during this attack. I want them to pay for this injustice. How long do I have to file a lawsuit against the employee and the store?
All right. This question we selected because it helps us talk about the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations is a period of time you have to bring a civil lawsuit against somebody for a wrong that was committed against you. In this situation, you have two different statute of limitations that may come into play. Her claim against the store might be for negligence. In other words, a negligent hiring. They didn't supervise the employees right. They didn't train the employees correctly, and that's what caused the problem. A claim for negligence has a 2-year statute of limitations. But if she wants to bring a civil suit against the actual employees because of their intentional acts, that becomes something more than negligence. We call that an intentional tort. And intentional torts have a 6-year statute of limitations that applies in those type claims against individuals or businesses or anybody else for an intentional tort. We're usually talking about an intent to harm, gross recklessness, wantonness, that type of thing that's a little bit more than just simple not paying attention or not being careful, which is basically mm-hmm. what negligence is. So again, in her situation, and we did counsel her that because this happened in 2018 and we're now in 2020, the 2-year statute of limitations for a negligence claim may have already expired or may be about to expire. And again, mm-hmm. if you don't meet that statute of limitations, the case is over. So the other thing we suggested was that there's also the possibility of filing criminal charges and seeking restitution against the individuals for assault and seeking restitution for the damages through the criminal justice system, because that is allowed. Victims can get restitution, and there's actually a victim's compensation fund that you can apply to if you're a victim of a crime to help cover medical bills that are not covered by health insurance and lost wages that may not be covered by time off of work. That information and forms can be found through the district attorney's office. But again, a very good question to help us distinguish between the 2-year statute of limitations for negligence and the 6-year statute of limitations for intentional torts or wantonness, which again, in Alabama, we also have a 6-year statute of limitations for contract claims, breach of contract, those type claims. But again, very important to know what that statute of limitations is, because once it expires, mm-hmm. Alabama is not very forgiving on the statute of limitations. So,
yeah.
All right.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you, Mark.
Our next segment, we're going to be talking about class actions and mass tort claims and cases. So stick around, come back and listen to us. And if you're driving and you get home, don't forget you can log in to FMTalk1065.com to hear us live. Be back in a moment.
Welcome back to Law Chat 24/7. To be a part of the show and to have your legal questions answered, email Mark Wolf. Details online at lawchat247.com. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Wolf and Marion Boatler.
Welcome back to our third segment. We're going to jump into the next three questions. They're dealing with class actions and mass torts. And our first one is a good question because it's going to help us distinguish and talk about the difference between those two. What's our first question?
Exactly, Mark. It is a question from Ron and Wilmer wants to know the difference between a class action case and a mass tort case.
They're similar in the fact that both of these type actions allow the victims to benefit from economies of scale. They're different because the damages or the claims of the victims are maybe different. For example, a class action may be a situation where a bank or utility company overcharges all of their customers a certain amount, maybe a dollar per billing cycle. Well, you can't go after a utility company and take them on a lawsuit for just a couple dollars. But again, you don't necessarily want to let somebody get away with something. If they're taking a dollar from 10,000 people, that adds up to a lot. And so that's the whole idea behind a class action, is all of these people with a similar damages can band together, and there'll be a few class representatives who represent everybody who's had this suffered the same wrong or same damage. So you don't have to file an individual lawsuit if you're included in the class. And many people, you may have received something in the mail that says you're a member of this class, you get this benefit. You never filed a lawsuit. May not have even known about it, but you've been included because you're a member of the class. And again, it allows for the prosecution of these type claims, because these cases can get very, very complex and very expensive to litigate. So you have the economies of scale. The mass tort situation is where similar, but the claims of all the victims are different. And this may be a situation where everybody has different reactions to a drug or a medication that may have been recalled. And therefore, the damages are not similar enough so that they can be prosecuted as a class action. In those situations, it's prosecuted as what we call a mass tort. And that technically is where everybody has to file their own lawsuit. And then these lawsuits are consolidated into multi-districts or multi-district litigation and overseen by steering committees and lawyers that handle certain parts of the case. But each individual claim is its own claim. And usually there's some sort of a structure on payouts if they settle, that if you're in this class or you had these damages, you had ABC damages, you get this. If you had DEF damages, you get this amount.
Mm-hmm.
But the multi-district litigation, it allows for the same benefit or the economies of scale, because again, the documents that are recovered, the expert testimony that's applicable to one case is applicable to all. So that's the mm-hmm. difference, and it's a way for people to prosecute cases that may be small and not able to be prosecuted independently without the assistance or the economies of scale. So that's a good question, and I appreciate that one to give us a chance to talk about the difference between those two type of cases.
Right. Well, good. And I think you definitely clarified the difference and the similarities. That leads us to our next question, Mark, is from Jennifer in Mobile, and she sent us the following question from Messenger on the Law Chat 24/7 Facebook page. She wants to know about her mass tort claim. A few years ago, she states, I saw an ad on TV for claims relating to taking X medication. I called and filled out all the papers and sent them back to an attorney. I've not heard anything back from the attorney and called her the other day to find out about my case. And she said my case had been transferred to another attorney in Michigan. She was pretty short with me. I tried to ask her why. I now just had a new attorney 1,000 miles away, but she just kept saying, call the new attorney. I think this is weird, and I'm suspicious about what is happening to my case. Should I file a grievance against her with the Bar Association?
All right. This is a very common problem we see in mass tort cases, and I think part of that is because a lot of times clients are not given the information about how the mass tort process works,
mm-hmm.
so they don't
mm-hmm.
understand what happens when we get into this situation that she's in, what we call the lawyer shuffle. We actually mm-hmm. have available at our website, brwlawyers.com, a consumer's guide to mass tort litigation that goes through and explains this whole process. And anytime we sign up a mass tort client, we explain this to them, we send them this booklet so they'll understand what may or may not be happening. For example, we have a number of Zantac cases that we are about to file, and those cases have been consolidated down in Miami. So we're going to have to file those cases in Miami. Now, depending on how many cases we end up with and end up having and the number of clients we end up with cases down there, it may not be economically viable for us to continue to prosecute those cases once they're filed. So at some point, we may have to look to affiliate and associate an attorney either down there or from somewhere else that may have a higher volume that is further along or is further up the food chain, so to speak, in the prosecution of the case. So then we may have to transfer our clients to that lawyer. Now, and that's what probably happened to her, is that Jennifer's case probably got transferred to another lawyer. The multi-district for her case may be up in the Michigan area, and it may have been just more economical for her lawyer to transfer the case to a Michigan attorney. None of this mm-hmm. affects the attorney fees. The fees are all set, so it's not, and fees are all approved by the court in these type cases, so it should not affect the overall fee. But again, we see a lot of times lawyers don't explain to the clients what's going to be happening or why this is going to be happening, and so they don't understand. And we try to make sure
right.
the lawyers that our clients understand at the front end that this is, I mean, some of these cases on the Zantac, I think they were looking at 3 or 4 different areas for mass torts. One was Miami, I think one was in California, and I think maybe up in New York. And the judges all kind of get together and decide who's going to take these different mass torts and become the multi-district litigation center. Mm-hmm. But obviously, had Zantac been in California, it might have been more difficult for us to prosecute those cases there. So that she's got caught up in the lawyer shuffle. It's not anything unusual and certainly not something that I would say she needs to file a grievance against the attorney for. I think more than anything, it was just a breakdown in communication with the attorney in that situation. So,
Well, thank you, Mark. The next question actually is from Mark in Mobile. Send us the following question about a class action. He states, I received a postcard in the mail that said I was a member of a class action against X Bank for overcharged service fees on some of my accounts with the bank. The card gave me a website to go to learn more about my claim and rebate. It also gave me a deadline to opt out of the class action. What does that mean, and should I do it?
Okay. Again, this is a situation where Mark probably had not actually even filed a lawsuit or may not have even known the class action was going. He just gets a notice that, hey, you're a member of the class, and this is the potential settlement of the class, and here's what your benefits are going to be. The opt-out is what that is short for is basically the client has the option to pull out of the class action by a certain deadline. And then that allows that, in this case, Mark, if he opts out of the class settlement, then he is free to pursue his rights and his damages independently or individually against the bank. Again, normally this is not a good strategy because of the cost of litigation. Again, if it's a $20, $30 damages for overcharged services, it's going to be very hard for him to litigate a case against a bank for that amount of money. So it may not be in his interest to opt out. But the interesting thing is, anytime you have one of these big class actions, sometimes there becomes a large enough group of people that opt out that they become their own secondary class action to the original class action. And we commonly call that an opt-out class. And so a lot of times we'll get calls from clients who with the same question as Mark, and with some quick research on some of the digests and some of the indexes that we have with nationally with different attorneys and posts and boards, we can find out if there's a viable opt-out class that they might want to consider joining. Typically, the opt-out classes try to hold out for more money. They don't always get it. It doesn't always work out that way, but that's what happens a lot of times. But that's what the opt-out date is for. If you don't opt out by that deadline, then you're automatically included in the class action, and once that happens, you can't go back afterwards and then go, well, I really want to pursue my own case. If you've missed the opt-out deadline, you can't do that. So, again, a good question, and it helps us distinguish the difference between a mass tort and the opt-out provisions in class actions and the multi-district litigation of these mass tort cases. It's just a very, like I said, it's a very complex area of law. A lot of times people see these TV ads on these mass torts, they'll sign up, but they don't really get a full understanding of the process. And that's what we're trying to do, is help educate our clients and consumers in general about how the process works and the benefits of a class action lawsuit. Mm-hmm. So, again, good stuff. And have you ever been a member of a class action that you're aware of?
I have not, I don't believe. If so, it may have come in the mail. And I just said, here's no, not. What is this?
Well, we got notice the other day in the mail that we're a member of a class action and against a utility company, and I think I think Kelly sent in the postcard for the rebate amount. It wasn't a lot, but we had no idea it was even going on.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for explaining all of it. I really do think that was very informative.
All right, and we're coming up on our next break in just a second, but I do want to remind people that you can get a response to your question in 24 hours, your legal question in 24 hours, by going to our LawChat247.com website, or how else can they do it, Marion?
They can go to the Facebook page and in the Messenger section of the LawChat247.com. and type in your question. Absolutely. And they will get a response.
Very good. And don't forget to listen to us live on your device or your computer at fmtalk1065.com. We'll be back in just a second. Thank you.
Welcome back to Law Chat 24/7. To be a part of the show and to have your legal questions answered, email Mark Wolf. Details online at lawchat247.com. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Wolf and Marion Boatler.
Welcome back to our final segment. Coming up near the end is our Can I Sue section, but before we get to that, let's try to squeeze in another question. What's up next, Marion?
Yes, this question is from Andy and Daphne. He has a question about a parking lot accident. He said, I recently was in a fender bender car accident as I was leaving a parking lot. The police came, but he said he would not write up an accident report because the accident happened on private property. He said he would prepare an incident report so that we would have it to give to our insurance company. What's the difference between an incident report and an accident report? That's a good question.
All right. All right. An accident report, the officer is a lot more detailed, and the officer actually provides an opinion as to who was the prime contributing unit or who was at fault in the accident. Now, that is just simply the officer's opinion and not necessarily binding, but an incident report is just basically that. It just says two cars collided in a parking lot. It does not try, the officer does not try to indicate who may or may not have been at fault. The officer will put some relevant information on the incident report, but certainly not anywhere near as detailed and complex as an accident report. In Alabama, it is pretty standard that law enforcement does not write an accident report for an accident that happens on private property or in a parking lot. Now, if you're leaving a parking lot going onto a public roadway, then an accident report might be written up. But the accident reports are reserved for accidents that do happen on public roadways or public right-of-ways generally. So that's the difference. But the incident report will suffice to turn the matter over to the insurance company, and they may still try to determine who was at fault or not at fault for the claim purposes. But so, in fact, we have our next question is also about an accident report, isn't it?
It is. This question is about an incorrect accident report. Valerie sent us this question from the LawChat247.com website page. She says, I just found out from my insurance company that the accident report says I was the at fault for my accident. I disagree with the officer's conclusion and want to file a grievance against him and get the report fixed to show the other driver as being at fault. How do I go about doing this?
Okay, well, first off, Valerie, do not file a grievance against the police officer for him rendering an opinion about what may or may not have happened in the accident report. What I said earlier, it is just the officer's opinion as to what happened. And it's an opinion based on hearsay. And so the courts generally, the accident report and the officer's conclusion are not admissible evidence on the issue of who was at fault. Generally, insurance companies will go by the accident report listing of who was at fault in making their determination, but not always. What I always recommend to people when they don't think the accident report, the conclusion of the officer is correct, is simply sending a letter to the officer asking him or her to review the situation and asking them to file an amended accident report. If you have photos or anything that better documents your position, then you might want to reference those or include those. Keep a copy of this letter. Most of the time, the officers are not going to do an amended report, but you want to have a copy of that report for your insurance company so that you can say, look, the officer said I was at fault, but I don't think I was. Here's the letter I wrote to the officer. I don't think I should be rated up higher for insurance purposes. Mm-hmm. So anyways, all right, well, let's jump into Can I Sue because we're running out of time. What's our Can I Sue question for the night?
Yes, Wanda in Chatham wants to know, can I sue for cigarette lighter exploding? The lighter exploded earlier when my son went to the car to sit down to smoke. He went to reach for his lighter, and about that time it exploded.
And this is a situation, we reached out to Wanda and found out a little bit more. Her son was a minor. He was 18. The age of majority in Alabama is 19. So when you're a minor, you can't bring a lawsuit on your own. So her question about can she bring the lawsuit basically would have been on his behalf. And fortunately, her son was not very badly hurt. The issue and problem in any type of case like this or claim like this is, again, what we talked about earlier, that burden of proof. She has to prove there was some sort of defect in the lighter that actually was the reason it exploded. I know all these lighters have warnings about leaving them in hot cars and not leaving them in places where they can get overheated and there is the subject to exploding. So there's a lot of issues of trying to prove that it was defective. You usually have to have a defective product examined by an expert, which costs money. So as we often say in response to these questions, can I sue? Well, yes, you can. But you may have a hard time finding a lawyer to take the case, and quite honestly, the expenses, and fortunately in this situation, her son was not hurt very badly. He just had some basic flash burn, so to speak, on his hand. So he was very, very fortunate. No serious injuries and nothing that would warrant the cost and expense and time of a products liability lawsuit. And again, we always tell people if you think you have a defective product claim or case, the most important thing is preserving that product, because the axiom among lawyers that do this type of work is if you don't have a product, you don't have a defective product case, because there's no way to examine that product and determine that specific product was defective and not have an expert look at it. Now, sometimes you can do it by example. We did that in a tire case several years ago. We had a tire we thought was defective. Actually, your husband Knox handled that case, was involved in that case. And we used some exemplary tires similar to the one that was on the vehicle and showed that this was a defect among that whole batch of tires, and we were able to get the case settled. We never end up actually had to try the case, but that's just a rarity. Most of the time, if you think it's a defective product, you need to make sure somebody preserves it or holds on to it. And we see this a lot. People get injured at work. They get injured by a tool that may have malfunctioned or been defective. And by the time they get to us, the tool has been either repaired or sold or thrown away. Mm-hmm. So there's no way for us to test it and check and make sure that it's defective. So, all right. Well, we're coming up to the end of our show. A great show, Marion. It was so nice to have you back.
I know. It's glad to be back. And I know hopefully next week we'll be in the studio, so that will be good.
Yeah, hopefully next week we'll be back in the studio and finish with all this remote stuff. But remember, people, you can listen to us each week through your device or your computer at fmtalk1065.com. Tune in. Keep up with us on our Facebook page so you'll know what we're going to be talking about each show, because we're trying to cover a lot of different areas of interest to a lot of people. Hope y'all learned something and had a good time. Marion, you take care.
Yes.
And we'll see you next week.
You too. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to Law Chat 24/7, sponsored by Boatler, Richardson, Wolf, Injury Lawyers, proudly serving the citizens of the Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida Gulf Coast since 1987. Learn more at brwlawyers.com. If you need a response to a legal question, go to lawchat247.com. That's lawchat247.com, and submit your question. And be sure to join us next Tuesday evening at 7 for another edition of Law Chat 24/7, when we will continue to review and discuss legal issues that impact you and our community.